want to thank Luke Hyken for being here. Luke and Alan Hopper and all the other attorneys with the Committee on Democratic Communication have spent umpteen hours for the last 5 or 6 years. Been successful in defeating not one injunction attempt, but two injunction attempts by the FCC to shut Free Radio Berkeley down. I mean, Luke and Alan and everyone else have been actually one of the very pivotal forces in keeping this movement going, because even though they come in with guns and federal marshals and other stations, we've been able to hold them back in Berkeley and San Francisco Bay Area and show that we can stand up to them, and we've been doing so now. This is also, this Saturday will be the 5th anniversary of Free Radio Berkeley being on the air, and largely due in part to Luke Hyken and Alan Hopper and all the other attorneys. So, Luke.
Greetings. I urge all of you not to take public transportation from south of the strip over here. I first of all wanted to talk about a certain level of reality. Lawyers don't create movements, and lawyers don't win cases without movements of people that are struggling to make those law, law precedents and those kinds of cases possible. I mean, the first sets of people that were conscientious objectors or anti-war advocates in Vietnam went to prison. They went to prison because nobody believed that you had a right to fight it. And by the time the anti-war movement built, there wasn't a judge in the country that wasn't ruling for people who refused to go fight that war. The FCC right now is about to legalize some form of micro radio. And they've gone even from calling our own panel here pirate radio, will they walk the plank, they're now calling it unlicensed radio. A little bit nicer. We have no problem with the concept of dealing with the pirates. I mean, pirates are people who steal the airwaves. The airwaves belong to the American public. The Communications Act of 1934 said that. It said it not only belonged to the public, but it even identified the context within that was within which that existed. We have a position paper that we're going to distribute. I have a few copies that I can leave here with you to the convention. But the FCC is supposed to be allocating the airwaves on behalf of the people of the United States without discrimination on the basis of race, color, religion, national origin, or sex. Now, if you think about who has access to the airwaves, you're talking about 11 major corporations that totally dominate the airwaves. There is probably no industry in the country that is dominated by white males to the exclusion of everybody else in the nation more than the communications industry. By their own statistics, less than 3% of the airwaves are owned and controlled by non-white people. And women know the extent to which they have no voice whatsoever on the meaningful media, Oprah and Diane Sawyer notwithstanding. So that when you're talking about who are the pirates and who've stolen the airwaves from the American people that are a resource that belong to all of us, it's clear that it's the NAB. And when you look at books such as McChesney's book, Telecommunications, Mass Media, and Democracy, and you see how from 1928 to 1934, there was a struggle over the airwaves and radio. And in fact, by 1934, the commercial corporations owned them lock, stock, and barrel. The NAB is comprised of corporations like Disney, Westinghouse, General Electric. These are multi-billion dollar corporations, not millionaire corporations, billionaire corporations. Together, their combined financial wealth is probably the greatest lobbying arm in the United States outside the Pentagon and the defense industry that now control 50% of our budget, in spite of the fact that we're in peacetime. But when you take that kind of power and then talk about how do the American people go about taking back the airwaves, you know why the struggle that you're involved in is so important. Because in fact, if spectrum scarcity was the real issue, as they claim it is, then you'd do what Americans do when there's a limited number of things. You have a lottery or a draft. You say one per person, we'll be glad to give Westinghouse one station. Give other people one station. We can figure out how to share that in a way that gives commercial broadcasters one set of access and the American people their proportionate share. But of course the NAB and the FCC aren't interested in really allocating the airwaves and allocating scarce resources in a way that is representative of the American public. If they did that, they would have to totally redefine how they allocate the airwaves. They're now talking about having 1-watt stations legalized. There's stations in, for example, Southwest Texas that are the only places in that area that they can broadcast their city council meetings or their local high school games or activities that are going on in those cities. A 1-watt transmitter isn't going to cover a rural area. They know that. By suggesting they're going to give 1 watt, they define themselves as encouraging and creating and making this struggle just continue. They've got to figure out a way of giving non-commercial voices a meaningful access to the airwaves. The impact of the Telecommunications Act of 1996 was to basically consolidate and merge these massive corporations, even to more, you know, even in larger corporations, number one, and permit them to own so many stations in one location that you now have basically three large conglomerates that control 60% of the radio space and programming in 50% of the major cities of this country. That's what the impact of this Telecommunications Act that was supposed to access the airwaves for the American people. It was a giveaway. And when you think about the fact that the NAB had the power to say to the FCC, we're going to shut you down as an agency if you don't pass this act and give it to us, you get some kind of sense of their power. What agency in the country is afraid of the lobbying organization that it regulates? What threat can the broadcasting industry pose over that agency? Well, that's a long discussion. Some people would suggest that the politicians of this country are absolutely dependent upon the broadcast industry for their very survival, and that the FCC, if it is not catering to those needs, who's the enemy at that point if you're trying to get elected? Now, there's another analysis which you can get from reading people like McChesney and reading the history of how the commercial broadcasters, we live in a period in which capitalism is God, right? Marketplace economics define reality, which in the concept of democratic communications is absurdity, because the very kind of dialogue you have to sell advertising is the most watered-down, least controversial kind of dialogue you can have. You want 47 Seinfelds, no content whatsoever, so that what you're doing while you're putting on all these different Seinfeld shows is you're selling the advertising. You're selling beer and tampons and God knows what they're going to sell, because the show has no meaning, because it has no substance. Because if it really offends somebody, the advertisers aren't going to use it. And that's clear, and nobody knows that more than the NAB. Their entire business is selling advertising space. And when you look at their brochures and their literature, they are as pleased as punch with the new Telecommunications Act. They have what they call more shelf space for advertising than they've ever had. But that is the opposite of what you want in a society that has got to speak to itself in order to solve problems. And that is where radio comes in. The penetration of radio worldwide is twice that of television. Radio reaches twice as much of an audience as television does, 4 times as much as the print media. There are entire communities that have an oral tradition that don't have a written tradition. There are communities that speak to each other and don't write to each other. There are many communities, not only around the world, but in this country, that don't own a press, a printing press. They don't own television studios, but everybody owns a radio. And with the help of people like Stephen and Tetsuo and the various engineers and workers around the country who have created systems and technologies, people for a few $100 can speak to everybody in their community about the kinds of democratic concerns that we have got to find a way of expressing in this society, because people are voiceless. People are voiceless. You don't own the newspaper. You don't own the television studios. And the radio, which is the one technology that everybody in this country could participate in, has been stolen from us by pirates. Only the pirates aren't little one-watt transmitters. The pirates are the people that have stolen your right to talk to each other. And it is clear as day when you hear a micro radio station that you're listening to a very different kind of sound than when someone's selling you Dodge Caravans. You're just listening to a different message. In California, in the last 20 years, there have been 20 prisons built and not one university. The only growing state agency is the Department of Corrections. The only powerful union that's growing is the Prison Guards Union, CCPOA, and it takes credit for having elected the last three Republican governors in California. The Department of Corrections just issued a ruling that no written media, no television, and no radio can go into any prison in California and talk to inmates. And they allege security as the basis for that. The media is as silent as lambs about it. They have not even stepped up to fight. Peter Sussman with the Chronicle complains. Do you think the media would stop for 5 seconds if they were going to financially lose off of that kind of ruling? Who are going to be the spokespeople for prisoners and for the families of prisoners? There are over 1.5 million people either in prison or on parole in this country. Who is going to have the right to get access to the airwaves to talk about the fact that a nation that builds prisons instead of schools is suicidal? Where do you get that dialogue? You're not going to read it in your daily paper. You're not going to see it on Channel 4. And you're not going to see it on radio to the extent that commercial broadcasters have to make money off what you're talking about. Michael Jordan and Tiger Woods make millions and millions of dollars working for Nike, right? Nike has left the American market. They have 12-year-old girls in China making Nike shoes. They work 10 hours a day, 7 days a week. By the time they pay for the dormitories that they have to live in, they make $3 a week. The people who are heads of those corporations are criminals. They should be in prison. They shouldn't be the multimillionaires they are. Who is going to discuss that? Is there a radio station in this country that's going to offend Nike or CCPOA or the various people who have defined the economy that the world is living in today at the risk of losing those sponsors? Why in the world could they or would they or should they? They shouldn't. That's economic suicide. So that the NAB should be the first organization that sits there and says, we have got to open up spectrum space for people to talk to each other, to engage in the dialogue the democratic nations are supposed to engage in. That is what the function of micro radio serves, which is why at the same time that the FCC is trying to get an injunction against Stephen, UNESCO is writing and asking for $5,000 worth of transmitters so that they can give them to rural areas in the Philippines. At the same time that the NAB is calling on the FCC to quickly get out there and arrest micro radio people, all over the world people are seeking and requesting access to this technology so that they can democratize their own areas. The absurdity of having the American government and institutions fighting that democratic process at this time is patently absurd. And so when you look at the legal fight that we're engaged in, it becomes clear as day that they are not interested in having a forum to argue over the question of whether they are complying with their requirements to allocate the airwaves in the interests of the American people with the lowest wattage necessary to accomplish what they should, employing new technologies for the service of the people. There's a whole bunch of slogans in that act that have not only been ignored, they've been trampled on as seriously as they could be. What they do instead is get up and procedurally engage in what to lawyers is the most blatant game that you ever see. They will do anything to avoid a trial on the question of are they allocating the airwaves according to their own mandate. So that instead they come back and they say to the court, You've got to issue the injunction, and you have the power to issue it, but you don't have the power to hear their defense. And the first argument was that they didn't even have the jurisdiction to hear the defense. They said to the same court that they went to, you don't have jurisdiction to hear our argument. She turned around and said, you sought the jurisdiction of this court. You clearly had the power to come into it. We were perfectly willing to say, all right, you don't have jurisdiction. We'll walk out then. I mean, if we're not in there in the proper jurisdiction, then they should go into the jurisdiction they want to go into. The court said, no, that's not so. Their next answer isn't, all right, well, then let's have a trial on whether what we're doing is lawful or not. They instead come back and say, even if what we're doing is unlawful, they can't raise that as a defense in your court because they didn't do A, B, C, D, E. And there's a whole bunch of technical nonsense that I could describe what A, B, C, D, and E are. We asked the court whether in the history of the FCC they had ever given waivers to anybody that had gone through A, B, C, D, and E. They said, no. We said, have there been anybody requesting? And they said, no, nobody's requested it in this particular form. And we said, here are 25 letters from people requesting waivers. That's the equivalent to your A, B, C, D, and E. You, the FCC, have the power through your own regulations to initiate your own rulemaking. You have the power to initiate these waivers. People don't have to go through hoops. It's one thing to ask Westinghouse to pay $100,000 to get a license. They have 8 licenses in about 15 different cities right now. They dominate a market. You understand? You're going to listen to 8 different stations, all owned and regulated and programmed by the same people. And there are 4 or 5 corporations in each of these cities that own those 8 and 9 stations. I've heard in Denver some of them own 12 somehow. I don't know what the legal games are, how they've been able to expand it from the 8 to have even more. But for an agency that's talking about spectrum scarcity to allow that kind of monopolization and not let you people put on a 2-watt transmitter is absolute nonsense and garbage. That's exercise of power that has nothing to do with the law. And you got to fight power with truth sometimes. You fight power by being willing to take the consequences and understand that at some point, you got to win. You know? It's not going to be in court, my guess, that the American people regain access to some kind of democratic forum to speak in. You can't speak in your living rooms in a democratic forum. Your living rooms aren't big enough. You don't do that in the parks anymore. You don't hand out leaflets to the numbers of people you have to talk to, and you surely can't engage in a 2-way dialogue the way you can with radio. Radio is the vehicle and the forum for doing that. The first thing a government does when it seizes power in a revolution is take over the radio station. That's not a coincidence. How do you talk to people in this world if you don't have the millions of dollars for a television studio and the money it takes to have a printing press and the paper and the ink and the constant need to duplicate it? And in nations where people have to talk to each other because they've been silenced, you can bet that the people who by coincidence just happen to own the power to control and dominate the airwaves, they ain't going to give it up easily. And they're surely not going to do it quietly. But like the Pete Seeger song said, take it easy, but take it. There are a couple of resources that people should know and read probably to understand kind of not just the legal history, but the political history of what's going on. McChesney's book, Telecommunications, Mass Media, and Democracy, is the best book that we have seen that analyzes the takeover of radio from what could have been a public access forum to the wholly owned subsidiary of the commercial broadcasters. And the FCC's been whoring for it ever since. They have never taken the part of the American people against the power and control of the NAB. Repeat the name of the book? Telecommunications, Mass Media, and Democracy. And then it's got a subtitle like The History of the FCC from 1928 to 1934. Another book is Stephen's book and Ron Sikalski's Seizing the Airwaves. The reason it's good is not just that it has explanations of how you do this sort of thing and talks about the legal history and analysis, but it gives you examples of the breadth of the communities and the resources that use radio. And when you read those, you get a sense of there is no way in the world that commercial stations can reach that goal. There's a women's radio station for women who are raising kids. They get together, they're isolated in their homes, they can't go out and work, they can't go meet people in meaningful ways. They set up a radio station in their community. They talk to each other about real important stuff. How do you raise kids? How do you feed kids on single incomes? How do you do, the various things that people have to talk about in a community, important questions. They could no more get access to a radio station to do that than they could fly to a commercial station. That's in Ireland. In Ireland. There are stations that, I mentioned the stations in Texas and Washington that we've gotten calls from. There's about a 6-county area up in I think it's middle of Washington. I don't know if any of those people are here. That is doing the broadcasting that real communication systems should do. They do the city council meetings. They do the public events that are taking place. They do the local athletic events. They serve the function that a meaningful local radio station should serve. Only the stations in that area either broadcast out of Seattle or Spokane, and they send you the easy listening music and they send you the nonsense, 57 stations and nothing on, because they want to sell you products. So that these people write the FCC and say, now how is it that we can set this up? The FCC itself has acknowledged that by April of last year they had 10,000 inquiries from people how to set up micro radio stations. 10,000 that called the FCC and said, how do we do it? The FCC's answer was, don't do it. But it's not a coincidence with that kind of groundswell, with that kind of grassroots response, that they're now saying, well, let's consider these 1-watt stations. They're going to try to minimize and marginalize the micro-radio movement. The last thing that they need are people talking to each other in this country about, are things going well? That's not a coincidence. So the people who feel the need to do that have got to understand that the means of communication are not just a nice thing to have. They're a prerequisite to organizing. They're a prerequisite to solving those problems. And the concept that NPR or Pacifica are going to accomplish that is nonsense. And I'm not talking about internal fights with Pacifica or that sort of thing. They are multi-million dollar corporations, both of them. They are commercial. I mean, anyone that can figure out the difference between underwriting and advertising is, has a subtle mind. You ought to go to law school, because there is no difference. Those corporations that fund. I listened to an NPR thing the other day. It was sponsored by Shell Oil. I mean, for God's sake, for them to talk about that as an alternative, it is a dishonest response on their part. They talk about spectrum scarcity and then talk alternative as if there's one voice that's an alternative. This is a pluralistic society. It's a society that has many voices. They are not in agreement. They are not in agreement. There are strong divisions over a number of issues: homophobia, sexism, racism, welfare, prisons. There aren't one or two voices. It's not like, well, we've now heard from Rush Limbaugh, let's hear from David Duke, and then we'll hear a third side from Pat Robertson. I mean, at some point, the American people are going to have to integrate into their own dialogue the meaningful plurality of voices that are there. Micro radio accomplishes that. It accomplishes it not by taking away the commercial broadcaster's spectrum space. That's what's so absurd, and that's why we decided to come to this convention. We wanted to confront the NAB straight on and say, look, you people can have your commercial stations. The difference between a 100,000-watt stupid radio station that sells products and a micro station that is talking to people in its community, giving them art, giving them poetry, having, when do you hear kids talk in this society other than on MTV or in juvenile court? This is a society that imprisons its teenagers. They put them in schools. If they make noise in schools, they give them Ritalin. They get out of school and they're put into AYSO soccer meets and things like that where the parents control it. Kids can't talk to each other. I don't think there's a micro radio station in the country that has not had teenage kids get on the air and run stations. They are wonderful. They talk to each other. They say things. Every parent I've ever known that had a kid that participated in micro radio said, this is the best thing that ever could have happened to this person. They now talk. They think responsibly. They take actions with recognizing the consequences of it. Of course there are going to be people on micro radio who say and do stupid things. You know? I mean, Rush Limbaugh doesn't have, you know, the sole control of saying stupid things. There are people on the left who say stupid things. There are all kinds of people who say it. There's a plurality of voices that got to be heard, and they're going to have stupid things to say. One of these micro radio people down in Tampa Bay loves David Duke, puts him on the air. And I've had people say to me, how can you represent, you know, somebody that do that? I mean, I don't mind. David Duke's on the air 24 hours a day as far as I'm concerned. I hear his rhetoric through Rush Limbaugh. I hear his rhetoric through McNeil Lehrer. It's modeled down a little bit. You know, they clean it up some. But where do you get to hear the voices that talk about why affirmative action might be important? Or why just taking money away from people who have no jobs and are living on welfare might be a form of murder and genocide, not just cleaning up the budget a little bit. You don't hear those voices, and the question is, where are the stations that can give them, and how do you go about doing it legally? The FCC has four... Am I going on too long?
Keep going.
The FCC has four vehicles for enforcing its power. One is they can arrest you and prosecute you for violating the law of broadcasting without a license. They did that to one of the people in Tampa Bay. They did it in a city that's as far from us as they could get, that is it's a very conservative judiciary in an area where there were no lawyers to defend the people. There are lawyers now that are looking into, and we believe will soon start bringing litigation on the whole question of the seizure, which is the second thing that they can do. But the first thing they can do is arrest you. They have done that once that we know of in about the last 15, 20 years. As we said to the judge in our case, we would love that case. We would love that test case. Because the proof is proof beyond a reasonable doubt, and there's no question that the illegality and unconstitutionality of a law and regulation is a defense to criminal conduct. I mean, the law is so cold on that we don't think we could even conceivably lose that. The second thing they can do is seize your equipment. We think what they're doing is illegal. Just blatantly, flat out illegal. They're going in, they're seizing the equipment, and they don't seize your equipment. They seize everything they can find that could conceivably use for communication. And because they're not creative enough, they haven't figured out how to take your socks. I mean, it seems to me that, you know, your socks and your underwear, you got to wear them while you're talking on the air. Therefore, they're vehicles for transmitting also. I mean, it's absurd. They have taken people's entire record collections, their books, their, things that have nothing. Pictures of Jesus. He said, well... No, he's seditious. I mean, the concept of what are the tools that you use to broadcast with has been so expanded by the FCC and its agents that we think Lori Wallach, who works against this in the corporations, the MAI, the globalization stuff, she has an expression she calls the Dracula theory, which is if it sees the light of day, it dies, you know? This is the Dracula theory. I mean, if people see what they're seizing and what the excuses they're using to take this enormous amount of stuff, they don't go in and seize the transmitter and the antenna to shut people down. They seize everything they own. It's blatant. We think we're going to win that one. We think what they're doing is illegal. But we got to figure out where to do it. You don't want to go to Tampa Bay and do it, quite frankly. I mean, you know, you want to do it where there's at least a 15% chance of getting some judge that's going to listen to it. But they can seize your equipment. There are a lot of cities, Kansas, Detroit, New Orleans, where there are stations in which lawyers that we're working with and that we know have written letters to the judges that they know, to the presiding judges of the federal courts in those areas, saying, I represent this station. Here's why this station is important to stay on the air. Here's the service that they're giving that no commercial broadcaster in this area is giving. We think what we're doing is legal. They cite the Dunifer case. They cite the arguments in our briefs and on the website. And they say to the court, if the FCC comes to you seeking a warrant to seize the equipment of my clients, call us first. We want a hearing on it. We don't want this prior restraint of you take everything and then we got to somehow go back into court having nothing to get it back. We want you to give us a hearing before you take our property. That's the American way, isn't it? You know? So, in those cities so far, there have not been any seizures. They have gone and seized equipment in Tampa Bay, you know. They've seized equipment in a couple of places.